Hello and welcome to Phil's Breakfast Special, episode 133. As I mentioned in the previous episode, I wanted to do an episode entirely focused on progressive power metal. Like, I've neglected power metal as a genre, like, quite a lot in this podcast. I've covered the odd album, but, like, really, it's not something I focus on at all. And to ease myself in, I thought I'd start on the progressive side of it. Now, the list I've compiled of bands I want to cover probably stretch the definition of actually being power metal. Some of these are pretty just straight up progressive metal, but they're with that, like, sort of Dream Theater leaning and a focus on some, you know, big hooky choruses that mean they've at least got a kind of related feel, and I guess some you might call, like, symphonic power metal or folk influence metal. And it's all in that nebulous vein, though, where I think if you're a fan of power metal, most of these albums should on paper appeal at any rate. So yeah, please don't pick me up too much in the genre. Also, at the end of the episode, I'm going to go through a load of listener suggestions, because the post I made about on Facebook actually got a really positive response. So if my list of stuff I'm calling loosely progressive power metal doesn't appeal, the listeners definitely set me straight at the end, and there's some real classics of the genre coming up there. So I want to start with a band that kind of very archetypal of the genre, like undeniably progressive power metal. So the first album I'm going to be covering is Enigmatic Calling by Pagan's Mind. Initially I was going to do their earlier album Celestial Entrance, but listener Mike Alexander, who's actually a guy back in the day, got me into a lot of the earliest power metal, I came across, suggested this album, and it's actually an album I think he lent me years and years ago, and I even covered on the podcast very early on, but I doubt many of you have heard that episode, so I don't really mind revisiting this one again. So what kind of makes Pagan's Mind so archetypal of this sort of genre, and what I think of as progressive power metal? Like, it's a genre that still very much exists, but I think was at some kind of a heyday when this album came out in 2005, it's sort of taking some of those sort of Dream Theater ideas of, like, this very arch musicianship, this, you know, somewhat metallic element, but not anything that would be considered particularly brutal or heavy by your standard metal fan, and mixing it with these very bright, very clean choruses, and the you know, very virtuoso, showy, often quite falsetto singers. Like, Dream Theater's influence kind of looms quite heavy over the genre, but there's a lot of other stuff going on there, and what a lot of these bands do that kind of elevates them in my personal taste over Dream Theater is not spend quite so long on the really indulgent musical departures. The stuff with Dream Theater show that they can play, like, you know, some of the best musicians out there, but being someone who doesn't really always quite understand the complexities of what's going on, sometimes this can be a bit long-winded. So to get back to Pagan's Mind, they're a band who've been going since year 2000 with a relatively stable lineup, and they have, like, the classic structure, I'd say, for one of these bands, which is vocalist, single guitarist, bass player, drummer, and a keyboard player. And they play a style of progressive power metal that's, you know, very rooted in these sort of big choruses. Like, not entirely dissimilar to Symphony X, who we were talking about in the previous episode. But I think these guys are a bit happier to sort of drag out a song. Like, their sort of average song length on this album is about 7 minutes. They will string a lot of riffs together to get to that sort of big payoff of a chorus. The first thing you'll notice about this is vocalist Nils Carew. I think he's unsurprisingly, like, very front and center, and he's an incredibly gifted vocalist. Like, he does a lot of this, like, really falsetto stuff, occasionally throwing in these ludicrously highest, like, almost like screams of hitting the highest note he can go for, but then will, you know, do some great stuff in the mid-range, and has a lot of fun with effects in his voice. Like, all throughout this album, he'll, like, chuck tons of echo or distortion on it. Like, for some of the heavier riffs, he'll put this, I think, really fun, like, distorted voice where it's not quite like a scream, but it's got a bit more bite to it than his normal clean. It's funny, like, looking at reviews of this band, he seems to be quite divisive as a front man, and personally I've always really loved his delivery, but I guess with this kind of stuff, like, vocals are so front and center that you're always going to either love or hate them. There's probably no real middle ground on that kind of stuff. Like, the lyrics are very sort of sci-fi themed. There's some interesting stuff going on. I've never really penetrated the concept of, I think these albums like all kind of tied together a lot of the early Pagan's Mind stuff, and I've never quite penetrated what's going on there. It seems to be a melding of the mythological with these science fiction stories referenced to like sort of interplanetary travel or galactic travel, but then this kind of more like interesting odd philosophical stuff. Like, I think it all means a lot to Nils Carew. I just personally don't hugely understand it. And then behind that you have like the sort of chorally songs. Like, a lot of them have these really excellent, often quite intricate guitarists. Jon Lofstad, the guitarist, is a very accomplished player, and like looking at a song, let's say Enigmatic Mission, like the guitarists for this are so sort of complex, where he'll throw these like really fast intricate melodies in, like it just in the spaces between the chords and stuff. But the songs will often slow down and be more led by the keyboards. Entrance to Infinity, like one of the really long tracks on the album, almost 8 minute one near the start, has these long sections where it's just sort of keyboards and vocals and a very simplistic rhythm section that will slowly build up to something more dramatic where all the guitars will come in. But for the most part, I don't think this is a particularly heavy album. It's very, very kind of clean and melodic, but it's interesting in the way the songs evolve. As I say, though, that the kind of 7 minute mark for a lot of them is quite well used. They go through a lot of fun movements, or like there is so many riffs that it takes to build to the chorus. There's something really enjoyable about the time it takes to get there. And as well, you have these really well considered sort of instrumental sections. Like, the guitar solos in these tracks are often kind of the highlight for me. But funnily enough, like as I say, like Jon is an incredible guitarist. Like, when he wants to really show off, that he's quite amazing. But the solos are very considered and melodically written, and often like not even fast. Like, they like a lot of them are like slow and not particularly complex. Often odd in a way, but yeah, they feel very sort of considered and so set to help the music. Like the one in Entrance to Infinity comes to mind for that. Like, it's just a cool kind of melodic passage. It's very front and center when it comes in, but it's not him showing like just how fast he can play or anything like that. It just feels like a cool moment. That being said, the one in Enigmatic Mission, I've always found absolutely hilarious for this. I like it, but it's kind of the most fast, like to the point track on the album. It's like the kind of the single, I'd definitely say. It's the heavy, like rocking one. And when it gets to the solo section, the solo is not long, but he throws in every technique you can think of. It's like, it starts off like doing some picking while depressing the whammy bar, then he's doing like pick tapping, then he's like sweeping, and then he's doing normal tapping, and all of this happens in like 20 seconds. And it's ludicrously impressive, especially if you see like a live video of him doing it. Like, how is he just leaping through all these different styles of playing so fast? But yeah, it always struck me as very funny. Just like, you don't normally get a solo like that where someone's like, I'm just doing all the different techniques just one after another. And it felt like, oh, that's his time where he's actually going to really show off, and he's got it into like the 20 seconds of that song. There's some nice instrumental moments on this. The track Coming Home always comes to mind. It's very cheesy, like sci-fi sounding keyboards throughout, but just has this great sort of building melody and this cool like sort of harmony lead between the guitar and keyboard that it really fits with the theme. Like, this album does feel very, very sci-fi, which works with the whole presentation of like, yeah, the lyrics and the frankly awful album covers, the blue naked woman flying through a magic circle. Like, Pagan's Mind, a band that you never really got it together in terms of album covers. All five of them are quite sort of horrible, really shiny CGI things that just don't quite work. But the music kind of makes up for it. I really like the mix of this, like the way the drums cut through works really well. Like the drum performance is really cool, and like in the some of the heavier moments when he gets to throw in like the double kicks or these like heavier sounding tom fills, like they add a lot to everything. The bass has got a solid presence. It's never doing anything particularly fancy, but with a band like this, I think it works being the thing that roots all of this down. Initially, yeah, as I say, I was going to cover Celestial Entrance, and that definitely has the most impressive sort of instrumental section. I think something they regularly do live, the Back to the Magic of Childhood, which is more of a track where they get to show off. And it's interesting with these albums, actually. Like, the band seem to have always gone for these kind of gigantic albums. They're always around the 70-minute mark, and it's the one thing I'd kind of hold against it, but is also a bit of a staple for the genre. Of like, for me, once I get to about track 7 taken, I've had about 45 minutes of the album. I'm like, normally that's enough. I rarely do this whole album one sitting, because 70 minutes is a huge commitment of time to kind of one style. And as someone who doesn't listen to so much of this music, it does have that thing where the cheesiness of it can get a little sort of exhausting. And it's tonally in a similar register throughout, although they are very good, as I say, like the kind of changes of bases and the build-ups are great. I just, with a lot of these albums, like it's hard to justify 70 minutes. All that being said, I do think Pagan's Mind, Enigmatic Calling is a really fantastic album, sort of well worth giving a go. It's a great kind of, you know, archetypal example of the genre, but it just has lots of nice unique touches. The vocal delivery, like Nils Geiru is a very recognizable singer, and he does well with the lyrics. Are kind of completely over the top and ridiculous in his own thing, but they never come across as annoying or anything like that. They do give the appropriate level of dramaticism that fits with the very over the top music. And sadly, like, they've got quite a short discography in terms of releases. They've done the 5 albums, I say, Celestial Entrance, the one before I really like, Infinity Divine, the debut's pretty good too, but their last album, Heavenly Ecstasy, was in 2011. They haven't really done a huge amount since, and I'm not sure of the reason for that, but definitely a band I'd like to hear more from. Next band I want to cover are Myrath, spelled M-Y-R-A-T-H. They're a Tunisian-based band, and apparently, according to their Metal Archives page, the first band from Tunisia to be signed on a label, which is kind of incredible. And they're a band you've probably come across. Like, these guys tour a lot. I remember seeing them supporting Symphony X like years ago, and honestly, listening to Hope, that is very unsurprising. Because right away with Hope, we have a sort of 2-minute instrumental that's like kind of very Middle Eastern folk sounding. And that does a lovely kind of merge into the opening track, Confession, where basically that intro continues on. Then you get this heavy chugging guitar come in. And by the time the keyboards, the vocals, everything has come in, this band sound very Symphony X. the vocalist immensely puts me in mind of Russell Allen, but the whole riffing as well has that kind of very heavy, like chuggy power metal kind of feel to it. Vocalist and keyboard player Elias Bechocha, I have no idea if that's how you meant to say his name, really has that Russell Allen thing going on of being able to do the kind of quite gruff, like angry sounding voice and then going into the really, really falsetto, catchy choruses. Like the opening track, Proper Confession, feels so in that vein. But then the title track, Hope, that follows it, feels immensely Orphan Land influenced, like really, really kind of leaning towards that kind of Mabul type sound. And then getting into an instrumental section that feels far more kind of Dream Theater influenced. Like the guys in this band, like probably quite young musicians at this point in time, like this is their debut album, and like for a lot of them they're their sort of first band other than like the previous project before this. And the people man really trying to show off, all these guys are putting in some very fancy guitar and keyboard solos. There's some amazing like dueling like solos going on in the instrumental passages, and they're good fun. All of it is somewhat sort of covered in this slightly rough production, but again, nothing that's terrible for a debut album. Everything is quite clear and present. It's just all has a slightly rough edge to it. There's just like this feeling throughout, and I honestly don't mind this, especially in a debut album for a band where each song is just like their influence. So like Hope is kind of very Orphan Land influenced, Last Breath feels very Dream Theater, Seven Sins, the big like 11 minute song that the album sort of revolves around, almost feels like one of those big Symphony X songs, one of those moments where like they throw everything in and go for a lot of movements and get quite neoclassical with it. Something I didn't realize, because I'm not deeply sort of familiar with the band, was actually the vocalist I've seen them live with, he's not the vocalist on this album. Sarah Zagatti, their vocalist since 2007, joins just after this album, so it's all the keyboard player, who I think is very recently left the band, doing the vocals. And it's amazing because I really think he has a voice that was like solid enough to be a front man. I love his voice on this album. Like Hope is probably the favorite My Rough album I've heard. Although, yeah, it has to be said, going through all this episode, like, I'm coming to this genre as quite an amateur. Like, I am by no means an expert on this progressive metal era or like the kind of broader world of progressive power metal. So yeah, this might be a very commonly known thing. But yeah, My Rough's Hope, really, really strong debut from, yeah, like being the first signed band from a country, it's kind of amazing that they've had something that's come together quite so well, because it's a certainly ambitious album. Like there's a lot of different styles in there, and even though like they're wearing their influences on the sleeve, like they do a very good job of every band they're doing an impression of on any song, and they've got their own flavors. They like throwing that sort of Middle Eastern folk influence into a Symphony X style song is a really nice twist on that idea. And when it comes to the kind of showy sections, they're very good at it. Like these guys can really play well. A fun detail I've only noticed in sort of researching this episode is the album was mixed by Kevin Cudfort of the French band Adagio, who was the next one I'm covering on, so this is a great sort of move across. And he does some, I think, like a nice keyboard solo on one of the tracks, and he's credited with backing vocals. I think he might be the guy that does the very occasional screams that are thrown in this album. I could be wrong. Like, maybe he's doing some different vocals. It's hard to tell. Like, as I say, the vocalist and sound really impressively has quite a range to his voice, but apparently just not something he went on doing. He wanted to focus on the keyboards.
I'm gonna go.
So the next band I'm going to cover is Francis Adagio, who I feel a band who have quite a reputation. Their early two albums, Sanctus Ignis and Underworld, I've heard mentioned quite a lot. The album I'm going to cover today, because it's one I happen to know quite well, is Archangels in Black, their fourth album that came out in 2009. I think talking of Mike earlier, I think he'd lent me Underworld like a bit before, so Archangels in Black was one I kind of bought as it came out. And not knowing my stuff about the kind of progressive power metal scene or the power metal scene in general, I worry I've gone for a very uncool album here covering Archangels in Black. I've got no idea if it holds up as next to the likes of Underworld, which I know to be very very popular, but I think Archangels in Black has got a lot of charm to it. It feels like at this point in time for Adagio, there's been some fairly significant personnel changes, like a different drummer, different vocalist. It seems to be the core of Frank Hermani and Stefan Forte, bass player and guitarist, like sort of being the ones leading this forward. And there's quite a distinct change in sound, I'd say, for Archangels of Black, where the earlier two of these very symphonic progressive power metal albums, Archangels in Black, as you can kind of guess from the slightly over-the-top title, that has a lean towards a heavier sound. So we still get all the very bombastic, clean vocals, but there's a lot of leaning on this very heavy detuned guitar. Like, the guitar parts are often, like, particularly the rhythm guitar is often quite simple, with the drums and bass adding these like more complex patterns, and the guitar just doing straightforward chugging or holding out like these big chords, while like the keyboards and the vocals fill out the sort of lead melodies. But then Stefan Forte comes back and just completely steals the show whenever he does a bit of lead guitar, not necessarily a solo, but every pattern of lead guitar he plays on this album is exceptionally memorable. Like, particularly you take a song like the kind of long one from the album Codex Obscura towards the end, there are so many of these great guitar melodies and they're really memorable. They're just things that will stick with you. I personally really like the vocal performance. It's very, I could see it being seriously divisive. Christian Palin is the vocalist, and yeah, they have like very intense delivery and go really falsetto, but they're always kind of uniquely carving out their own quite weird melodies. Like their approach to this kind of singing is very, very unique, and like you'd notice them in a crowd of power metal vocalists. I think they do really stand out if their vocal melodies aren't always the most obvious choice, but they are sort of very memorable. And I do enjoy the choice to go a bit heavier with this. Like, it's something that a lot of bands sort of did at this time period of, I think like this is 2009, so sort of at the peak of sort of metalcore being kind of huge. Not that this has a metalcore influence, but it does feel like a bit of that American metal influence has seeped in here to like the way they've mixed things. The decision to add some, like, there's a couple of like bits of scream vocal, much like the Minor Wrath album, which I think are used to great effect. They come in like very occasionally, and then there's like even like semi blast beats. The tracks like Vampire and Codex Obscura both have these moments where it just suddenly goes incredibly brutal in the middle of the song. I think it's Codex Obscura that has this like really gentle, beautiful passage of just clean vocals and keyboards that then just explodes into this sort of blasting like fury with this long like really echoey scream going over it. Oh, sorry to confuse that. Like, that gentle passage then goes into the big keyboard solo that's like over actually quite a heavy riff. Like, it's a very headbangable moment, which is a weird thing to say about a keyboard solo. But then later in the song we get this kind of gentle like neoclassical kind of synth moment that sounds very faux orchestra, and then that blows out into this like almost near black metal 30 seconds of the song that neatly transitions back into the chorus. And I think that's what I like, why Codex Obscura is such a standout track, because it has all these like bizarre different passages, like all the way from that like kind of bluesy lead over some keyboards in the middle to like a black metal bit, but it all feels like a natural earned progression. I think though the main issue I have with this album, say versus Underworld, is its kind of consistency. Like, moments like Vampire, Fear, Circus, the title track are fantastic, but then a couple of tracks aren't quite as memorable. Whereas, I'd say something like Underworld is pretty consistently great the whole way through, but might get exhaustingly neoclassical for some. There's less of that in here. It's still present, but it's not so consistent throughout. That kind of leaning on the heavier end of things helps. There is a little bit of tryhardiness in the kind of more metallic end of it. Like, the album cover always felt slightly hilarious, of this like sort of bloody angelic figure with nails in his head over this like burning sky, which for a band who, like, what's the cover for Underworld is just like a statue of a crying woman with a filter on it, feels like quite a dramatic shift. And there's a little bit of that in the lyric, but there's always a slight risk of that when a band makes a drastic like sort of direction change. Like, there's so much they do right on this album, and the songs that I really like are genuinely like nightmarish for getting stuck in your head. You will remember these inside out once you've listened to them. Sadly, like Pagan's Mind, this is another band where there isn't a great deal of story after that. They've got one more album in 2017, and then 740 seems to have put the band on hiatus after this point, which is a shame, because again, another one I'd like to hear more from. But also, going on his Metal Archives page, my god, is he a cool looking guy. Like, you've got to look up his picture, it's amazing. The other thing before we move on is, because the phrase has come up in the last couple of episodes, I had to look up what adagio means, and according to Google, it's a term that means played slowly. If a symphony has an adagio moment, it's a section that's played at a slow tempo. Adagio can be an instruction on a piece of sheet music directing the musician to play slowly. So I assume this is when classical music has a breakdown in it, which honestly isn't a terrible description of Archangels of Black. I can already how much I'm dead. If I had the wheels across the line, getting on my feet, sweating cold, tearing eyes, making love with ghosts before I need the tiny tales from end of time. With this next band, I know I'm picking the uncool album, but that is intentional. So this is Sun Caged with their third and final album, The Lotus Effect, from 2011. Sun Caged are relatively well known for their self-titled debut. It's a fantastic album. Honestly, if I had time to do as many albums I want on this, I'd really like to do that one as well. But it's, yeah, a very sort of classic progressive power metal album on the more progressive end of the scale. It's you know, it's a very musician-y, show-offy album, but it done with, like, very tastefully. It's a really cool album. I genuinely really like it. But the kind of tragic thing with that album is Marcel Cohen, who is guitarist and the kind of band leader, for whatever reason, the band just dissolved around him, and he had to form a totally new band from scratch with this, but like following on from this, he managed to release two more albums. I've never heard it, but the kind of consensus on the second album is it just didn't quite work out, and for whatever reason, it's not a very popular album. But I think the band actually came back really strong for their final album, The Lotus Effect. It is, as I say, it's on the very progressive end of progressive power metal. Like, the opening track, Seam Ripper and the Blanket Statement, is all over the place. It has this really kind of bizarre intro, like, which starts off very kind of aggressive, like, The only thing that really makes it clear you're in the kind of progressive power metal territory is the keyboards layered over this very harsh kind of insistent double kick driven riff. And then about a minute 30 into the track, the kind of the pace of the drumming slows down. We go into this like kind of stop starty chuggy riff, and we finally get to hear the vocals come in. And the vocals will be the thing that's an acquired taste about this album. Paul Villarreal is, I really like their vocal delivery, but they are very kind of syrupy cleans. Like they're kind of very emotional, and like he doesn't have the biggest range, but his natural voice sits in quite a high register. Like he is not the most accomplished like a singer in this genre is going to get, but he works really well for the songs, I think. And it's a shame because he doesn't seem to have done a huge amount after this band, and I genuinely think his performance does really help carry this album. As you'd expect when an album's more on the progressive end of the scale, it isn't so rooted in the vocals. Like they have their big moments in the Seam Ripper and Tiptoe, like his choruses are like sort of a really big deal, but there is huge instrumental sections. We get some amazing work from the musicians. The drums are ever complex in this. Like there's some proto-gentisms in the riffing. I think there's a lot of that low-end chugging stuff and all like the kind of rhythmically guitar, bass and drums all perfectly syncing on these quite intricate like funky timed riffs. But then you get like the fancy leads. The guitar work is fantastic. Marcel has just some amazing solos on this, but not to be outdone, Rene Kroon, the keyboard player, some of his solos are so memorable. Paradoilized, the long track towards the middle of the album, has this absolutely brilliant keyboard solo in it. The only issue the album has is, again, being a bit long and leaning to some moments that just don't quite work. So it's about 70 minutes, and the first half hour of it is really solid. All the first five tracks are these really great progressive power metal tracks. Then on Lotus, it kind of oversteps it and goes too ballady, and that song just does not work for me. It's where the kind of that sort of aforementioned syrupiness of the voice just grates a bit too much. But then comes out really strong for Paradoilized, like the really like this is the big progressive Dream Theater-y number where like they go just all over the place in terms of the music and come up with all these great ideas. That's brilliant. And then it does something, there's a few albums I've got that do this kind of thing where it's a load of like minute and a half sort of instrumental, or like I think some are vocals on, but they're like different ideas and they sort of go a bit all over the place and none of them are that good, and it just feels like it's like the album has that really great like epic moment and then just five tracks of sort of noodling about a bit, and then the closer, Let It Wash Away, is pretty good. But yeah, just it's one of those, I think if it was a bit more condensed, like it would be an incredible album. As it stands though, it has some truly brilliant moments on it. Yeah, the high points on this one are good enough, they're definitely worth giving it a go. And there's a lot I like about it in terms of like the cover is completely unique. It's a sort of doctored picture of this like mad scientist character, sort of, I'm not quite sure what they're interacting with, but something is just exploding out in like a wall of different colors and flowers and stuff, and that I think that's a really really cool idea. And yeah, a lot of the delivery is very very memorable. Like this is a group of musicians who they all have their kind of signature sound. The bass playing, even like there's sort of the bass solos and weird moments in this where like the bass really cuts through and gets to have their place in this quite complex mix, especially with the drum performance this all over the place, and you know, guitar and keyboard player who have that level of ability, and like Marcel Berg, and like, you know, a very noticeable guitarist, like someone who's Most notably worked with Arion. He's the guitarist. If you've seen the Live Equation DVD where they play the Human Equation in full, he's the guitarist for that. So an incredibly accomplished musician if you can, you know, play in that kind of thing. Not many of the others have gone on to a lot other than drummer Roel Van Helden now plays drums for Powerwolf, or has for them since I think about the time this album came out. So yeah, he's gone on to bigger things. And fair play to him, incredible drummer. I think I'm coming off a bit harsh on the Lotus Effect, like sort of saying it has moments it doesn't work. I guess it's kind of the ambition of the album. Like when you break down what's going on any different track, the band are so often trying like completely wild things within the template of progressive power metal. Like the as I say, the bass like cuts through a lot, where you'll just get over a verse, like this really kind of aggressive slap bass will come in and try and meld with the melody, or there'll be parts where there's quite complex vocal melody going on, then Marcel's guitar playing will just go all over the map, but he'll, you know, such like the mix will just about hold it all together. It still sounds kind of catchy and memorable, which is always the difficulty with this kind of stuff, because it's sitting in a genre that is so key to like having memorable melodies and catchy sing-along moments. You can't just go off the map in terms of technicality, and these guys, when they get it right, are amazing for straddling that line of very technical, weird, out there playing that comes back to still being fun and memorable, and, you know, has its kind of sing-along moments almost. Vanish my new home. Learning to see the other side of a child's memory that's ripping at the seam. With rare next album feels like a very good follow-up to The Lotus Effect. This is Speaking to Stone's second album, Elements, from 2012. So Speaking to Stone's another progressive power metal band. They are a five-piece, or the usual lineup you'd expect from that, like following on from this, an American band as well, who have an interesting, like, this is the only album of theirs I've really got into, but they've changed vocalists with each album, which makes them sort of a hard band to go through the discography of. But for me, Elements is the one where they sort of really get things right. It's got a fantastic mix to it, where just like it is a quite similar approach, I'd say, to what Sun Cage were doing, if slightly less experimental. I'd say a bit more focused on the sort of big riffs, but the way it's mixed, things sound really full and heavy. The guitar tone is massive, the bass is really present and full, and what they have going for them on this album is Anders Engberg of Sorcerer fame singing for them, who has got a fantastic, like, well, his band are normally a doom band, but they're that doom band that lean on the heavy metal, and this guy can carry a vocal melody. Like he can just belt out stuff over. If it's a heavy riff, he will sound amazing over it. And for this album, like, yeah, he is just brilliant, like, coming through these amazing vocal hooks. The opener Fires, like, a really good introduction to the album, where, yeah, it's kind of the heavier, more direct riffing. Anders comes in very early with his vocals, and they are just this brilliant, soaring, epic, heavy metal voice. But then, as with any track in this album, there is, you know, a massive instrumental section, some of it focused on being kind of dramatic and atmospheric, and then, going into just ridiculous kind of solo work. Anthony Brown and Tony Vici, the guitarist, like, have a Santi is a keyboard player, I should say, have a fantastic back and forth. Like, both of them are clearly ridiculously accomplished musicians, and their solos are very, very self-indulgent, but I find, like, there's a real sort of charm to the sound, and they get away with having a lot of time spent on those bits by, like, the riff writing around it being good. Like, they're just, like, really solid riffs, and you're kind of happy to let those musicians go for a bit. And I guess if I'm sort of focusing in on those bits, a lot of that is down to the drum and bass performance being really intricate and interesting throughout. They never do the simple thing. It's always throwing extra notes, extra fills, just making it that little more intricate and complex, which is really, like, it works in the album's favour. And the songs on this are long, but fortunately they restrained themselves to 5 of them. I think the shortest is not the best part of 10 minutes. But they take that time to put interesting sort of movements in there, you know, going to, like, places of very classical sounding piano over, like, acoustic guitar that will slowly build up into the bigger sort of heavier riffing. The moments that work least for me in it are where they sort of go a bit light on, like, I don't mind them going into the acoustic guitar stuff. That's kind of great. That transitioning back into the heavy metal riffing works really well. It's songs like Water that go a bit classic rock almost. I think those don't work so well. They don't play to the strengths of Anders' voice, and that's kind of the thing you had to get right in this. For all the progressiveness, you've got one vocalist, there's only so many different styles they can do, and yeah, when the music has gone a bit more classic rock, I don't think it doesn't really lend itself to the power of his voice. But then things come back very strong, like Earth, the big 15-minute epic, has some really fantastic moments in it. I think the main issues I really have with this album are the sort of the presentation of, like, the cover is just really hard to look at. I don't know what the hell's going on there. And that idea of the 5 tracks, the Fire, Wind, Water, Earth, and Quinta Essentia, which was the 5th element, I think, it's a bit trite. But more so than probably any of these other albums, if you want to hear 4 just incredible musicians, like, going off on one, like, really, you know, really going out there and, you know, just being incredible for the best part of an hour, but grounded with, like, still being some big chorus hooks, some amazing vocal moments, I think this is the one to go for. This is the most, like, musicians being ridiculously showy, but with just enough restraint that it's still, like, a fun out, like a really genuinely fun listen, rather than, you know, descending into the realm of technical exercise. Can't remember if I said the band name enough times. The band is called Speaking to Stones, and the album is called Elements. By complete fluke, I'd been going in chronological order up to this point. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to break with this. The next album is from 2004. It's the 4th and final album by the Italian progressive metal band Time Machine, Reviviscence Liber Secondus. Reviviscence? I think that's how you... Oh my god, I really don't know. I have no idea what that word means. So, Time Machine are one of those interesting bands where they have so many lineup changes. They're quite different album to album. I had a real dilemma which of theirs to pick. Both Eternity Ends and Evil are really good, more kind of traditional prog power albums. I kind of just wanted to go with this final one because it's really strange. And it also has a thing, my friend Pete introduced me to this band at uni, and we were just completely obsessed with the guitar that opens Rotten Souls, the first track proper. So, as I say, the band changed the lineup a lot. Like, for those three albums, they have three different lead vocalists, and not much of the personnel from Evil makes it onto Reviviscence. I can never say that title. It's mainly guitarist Gianluca Ferra and bass player Lorenzo Deo, who we've come across. I think Lorenzo being like the founding member of the band, he sort of kept going throughout. And this has a much less professional sounding mix to it because of the very clearly programmed drums, and you know, really has that energy of a band sort of in flux. But with that, they try out a lot of different things. Like, the album starts with this very sort of classical-inspired intro, Obscurity Within, which then really neatly transitions into Rotten Souls, the first track of the album, which opens with a minute of utterly ridiculous guitar playing. A level of shred. I remember first year of uni, like, being where I'm Pete, showing me this band and just being like, what the absolute fuck is that guitarist doing? This like ridiculous sweeping tapping melody. I was like, this is just mind-blowing, like a level of shred guitar. Like, I know it's uncool to be like really blown away by just a crazy bit of guitaring, but he finds like a way to, you know, get some melody in there and have it be more than just a technical exercise, although technical it surely is. And then like eventually we get some vocals come in with Marco Civo, who, again, like a guy with not a huge amount of credits as far as I could see. But yeah, he's got a solid voice. He's not incredible. And I think along with the mix, he's probably the part of this album that may be off-putting for people. But honestly, his voice works really well with it. It's just not quite as bombastic as you would expect for this kind of genre. Like, he does manage to get a few like really sort of catchy choruses into the album. The band for it out of the album keep throwing weird and wonderful things at you. There's a lot of bizarre interludes, like short like keyboard passages that feel, you know, say more in that neoclassical vein, like the intro, a lot of acoustic guitar, and then inside songs we get quite weird moments, like Grains of Sand feels like the melodic kind of ballady track of the album, but then in the middle goes into this very wild solo section. Tears of Jerusalem almost leans towards this kind of sitar type melody throughout. Like, I don't know if that's an actual sitar, but like, there's a lot of fun with acoustic instruments in this, and they're blended really nicely into things. And the like, it does feel like this album to some extent is quite a vehicle for Gianluca Ferra at this point. Like, he's really leading it, and unsurprising that, you know, not long following this he would go on to probably a like far more successful sort of solo career as an instrumental guitarist. And full disclosure, I've met him a few times, and he is a incredibly lovely human being, and his solo stuff is well worth checking out. I think Unheimlich was the album of his I got quite into, but yeah, he's very, very fancy technical guitarist. He can do this like really, like, the technique that was like so blew me and my friend Pete away at uni, I believe he's doing on the opening track, is this like eight finger tapping thing where, yeah, he'll be like playing notes with all eight fingers like going across the neck. That's amazing. Like, seeing him do it live is incredible. It looks like spiders running across the guitar, like absolutely, absolutely ridiculous stuff. And like, his guitar work is ever present on this. But it is nice to hear him in the context where he does still have like a vocalist coming in and adding some really big choruses from a band who, you know, have been very good at writing those in the past. Like, they're like album to album, they have a real knack for dropping a catchy chorus. And I think if you're looking for a more polished kind of classic progressive power metal sound, Eternity Ends would probably be the album of Time Machines I'd recommend. Like, Reviviscence sounds a bit more, it does have a slight almost demo quality, and I think it's the way the drums are programmed that sort of lets it down that front, but just the weirdness of the writing makes it one that stands out as just quite interesting for me, and one of those bands as well where it's just they've got an interesting little legacy and I don't hear them talked about all that often. Album before I get to the listener suggestions is Redemption's Long Night's Journey into Day. So we talked about, like with a couple of the other albums, the difficulty of changing vocalists, particularly in a genre like this where, you know, these sort of vocals are so front and center in the band, and they had some quite big shoes to fill in this one. So the previous vocalist of Redemption is Ray Alder of Fate's Warning fame. And he'd done like the last five or so albums. So, although despite being a US band, Redemption brought in Tom England of Evergrey to take over, and he is just an amazing fit for them. If you're not familiar with Redemption, again, they're on that sort of very sort of technical, flashy end of the progressive power metal scale. Like, there is the ever presence, like, kind of Dream Theater influence in there. Like, there is ludicrous musicianship throughout most their tracks. The, like, Nick Van Dyke, the main guy behind the band, like, he's lead guitarist, keyboards, and does all like the mixing, mastering, which is very impressive because this is a huge sounding album. Like, the recording and mix of it are absolutely fantastic. So he's taking the lead on that. That's very impressive. Engineering, producer, mixing, mastering. Like, the drums on this sound so good. And I wonder how much of this is a band that have been working together for a very long time. So since Origins of Ruin, their 2007 album, same drummer, bass player, and guitarist. And it definitely shows, like, this band, like, they lock in so well on these very intricate riffs. Drummer Chris Kurat really does his best to make every riff as filled as possible with his drumming, like endless, like, sort of tom rolls and just throwing in like as many hits as physically possible, seemingly. But it leads to the finding these amazing grooves in the song. Sean Andrews, the bass player, is often doing something like wildly complex underneath. But what really makes his work so well and, like, come together perfectly is Tom England just finds a way to always make his voice be present and, like, cutting through all the kind of wild technicality to find, like, a really good melody to bring everything back on. He sounds so great throughout this, like, bringing that sort of energy he has with Evergrey, who are a much more, although certainly progressive, much less kind of all over the place or busy as Redemption. Redemption very much feels like something where every musician is trying to put in their most complex performance at any given point. There is, like, yeah, there's some fantastic moments of the vocals, and, like, a lot of the lyrics have that kind of edge of being sort of political without ever really saying a hell of a lot, but they're also never particularly cringeworthy. I never found myself like running up against them in a negative way. Like I think the combination of the sincerity of the delivery and the kind of dynamic riffing kind of makes it all come together. Like it doesn't ever spoil itself where it could, especially because it's a long old album. It's like 65 minutes, and there is a hell of a lot of vocals throughout it. There's plenty of moments where they could go wrong, and for me, it kind of works throughout, even when tracks like Indulge in Color are so over the top and earnest, they would have a tendency to fall into kind of silly territory, but they just straddle that line perfectly. And actually, like, that aforementioned track is probably the highlight of the album. There's a great video of all the musicians on it playing their parts, because it's like a moment where the bass playing gets really complex, and there's quite an interesting instrumental build up in the middle. So really, really fun one to get to see what everyone's playing on it. As I say, it's another 65 minute long. It's a big album. Not all of it's at the same level. Tracks like Echo Chamber, Indulge in Color, and the title track at the end are pretty like real highlights, whereas like there are moments that aren't quite as exciting. A few tracks I might skip on repeat listens, and the cover of U2's New Year's Day felt somewhat unnecessary just because it's already quite a long runtime. Like, it's not a bad cover by any means, but I have no real attachment to the original, so I don't know, others may find that more offensive or not. But yeah, I sort of really enjoy this, and it's coming from a band I have a sort of interesting relationship with. I've known them for a long time, sort of Fullness of Time and Origins of Ruin I've had for years, and I really like moments of this band. From Fullness of Time, the track Sapphire, the 15-minute long one, I think is amazing. But then I don't really listen to a lot of that album. And Origins of Ruin has a similar thing of I like some of it. Their album before this, The Art of Loss, I can't get through at all. Just like totally wasn't for me. So to come back with something like this with a change in lineup as insignificant as a new vocalist, and just blow me away, and it'd be something I just listened to over and over again when it came out, was really, really impressive. I guess what's interesting about this album versus some of the others we covered is that one of the real standout parts of it is actually the rhythm section. That drum performance is one of my big takeaways from it. Like, Nick Van Dyke is an incredible lead guitarist and plays some really flashy solos throughout, but you know, we've talked about a lot of albums with a lot of flashy solos. I don't think he's necessarily above any of those other guitarists. Like, seemingly an incredibly tight rhythm player, though. Like, this album sounds really watertight, which I guess you can only tell so much of a newer album. I can't remember if I mentioned this is relatively recent, a 2018 release, but like, it does sound incredibly tight despite the complexity of everything going on. The funny thing, actually, in terms of the lead playing, is easily the best solo on this album from Indulge in Color is played by Chris Poland of early Megadeth fame, who comes in and has like, he's given like a full minute over a really good section, and he just plays this incredible solo. Genuinely, like, I love the idea of like coming in like a guest like this to a very technical band and just completely upstaging them on the solo writing front. So to say, this is an album I got really obsessed with, and I think if you're looking for something in this kind of vein where they let the drummer go a bit more loose, where that's the member of the band who really gets to show off, this is definitely one worth checking out. Particularly actually if you like Evergrey, like Tom England's appearance on this is pretty excellent. Like, he really, for a kind of new musician to a band, shows he can, like, you know, doesn't have to stick to riffs he's sort of like part of the writing of. He can turn up to something new like this and really put his seal on it.
I'm
Right, I think that's enough of my terrible taste in progressive power metal for now. As I say, I put out a thing on Facebook and got some suggestions from listeners for some other albums to cover, so I'm going to do a slightly more brief run through of their suggestions. Apologies if you don't use Facebook or anything like that. I'm sure I'll do a follow-up episode, so if I've not touched on any of the bands like you really like in this genre, please recommend me an album. It's a genre I'd like to dive into a bit more. But this lot of suggestions we got had a great range for some classics and some stuff I really, really didn't know well. So the first one I want to talk about was recommended by Brian Seamus Hennessy. This is Fate's Warning, No Exit. So, as I've been saying for this episode, the spectre of Dream Theater leans ever large over all these albums. This early 2000s scene, they have a huge influence on. But I've heard it said that, I mean, particularly in the book Mean Deviation, that they really propose this theory that the kind of trifecta of bands that are responsible for that influence are Dream Theater, Queensryche, and Fate's Warning. And Queensryche and Fate's Warning were much ahead of Dream Theater. So No Exit is their fourth album, Cool Connection to Redemption. It's the one where we get the new vocalist join the band. So Ray Adler joins them for this album. And yeah, he's the guy who just had left Redemption before that album. And yeah, so this is their fourth album, 1988. Same year as Queensryche put out their third album, Operation Mindcrime. And the year before, Dream Theater would put out their debut. So these bands are a little more proto. And No Exit definitely has that feel to it. It's got a lot of, like, old heavy metal in it, particularly in the guitar playing. So the guitar playing is fantastically flashy. The two guitarists, like, are shredding non-stop through this. Like, the opening track, Anarchy Divine, is just, like, endless solos. Like, you know, every bit where there's no vocals or even clashing with the vocals. And then Ray Adler, his vocal performance is very much of that 80s vein of heavy metal singer, where it is all in this, like, shrieking falsetto. But it, like, because it's so intense, it's kind of, like, got this abrasive edge to it. So the music comes across as quite harsh and pretty heavy, really. Much like with Queensryche, until very recently, I really hadn't listened to Fate's Warning. I brought it up a few times on the podcast. They're one of those bands, like, I've been meaning to get into, but just never have put the time into. And I've only given No Exit, like most of the albums in this list, I've only given it a once over. But it was really enjoyable and would definitely be something I'd be tempted to go deeper on. It's interesting with those two bands, like, they're compared to. They are quite different. Like, they are far harsher in their approach. Like, they are certainly a heavier band. Like, it's kind of puts me in mind in places of stuff like Watchtower, although not quite as technical, but it's that level of, like, sort of every musician in the band sort of playing at a 10 of, like, their most, like, fastest or highest or most intense thing they're gonna do. The only, like, real downside is I hate the album cover. It is incredibly ugly. I don't know what they were going for with this. I think I kind of hate the title too. No Exit is kind of a terrible title. But yeah, Fate's Warning, definitely a band I'd be tempted to dive deeper on. I get the impression the first couple of albums are all sort of pretty legendary, so I might just work my way through their discography at some point soon. Yeah, thanks for suggesting that one, Brian. It was great to finally sort of take the plunge on this band. Now, these next three bands that were recommended are where I really feel awkward discussing power metal, because they're all such sort of legendary, long-standing bands in the genre that I just feel so out of my depth talking about them. There's so much kind of to know and history and interesting stuff around them and change in direction and all that. Much like in, you know, I mentioned recently getting really into Blind Guardian, like, all of a sudden just, you know, taking the plunge and getting my head around that band, that's something I'm, like, a really big fan. But that took, you know, I had to get my head around, like, eight albums to sort of understand them. So the three bands that got recommended by a few people are Camelot, Rhapsody, and Sonata Arctica. So let's start off with Rhapsody. Ryan Smith recommended their album Dawn of Victory, and it's always been one that's sat in a weird place to me. Like, Rhapsody, the couple of their albums have these amazingly, like, sort of gory, almost Warhammer looking artworks, which like years ago, much like something like Gravedigger, when I first saw them, I was like, oh, this is going to be some heavy stuff. And I got to the music, like, oh, that's very, very power metal. Yeah, I've got to apologize on this one, Ryan. I did not manage to crack Rhapsody. I feel with the whole the Rhapsody of Fire thing, the split of the band members, there's so much sort of history to the band that I feel like I need to read a book to kind of understand at this stage. And there's a lot to kind of get your head around with their music, I guess. Like, I enjoyed this album well enough, but I don't have any real comments to add on the, and with a band this big, yeah, it definitely felt like, you know, they had some great choruses, the vocals are unsurprisingly incredible, and the writing was this really cool sort of symphonic sound. Like, they seem very good at that, like, faux orchestration side of it. Like, they're clearly very gifted songwriters. But yeah, on first pass, I don't think I, like, you know, fully got to grips with this one. And their band, I feel I really need to dedicate a lot more time to. Similarly, Mike Alexander and Simon Turner recommended Camelot's Black Halo. And the Black Halo is kind of a legendary one of theirs. I think it's like sits quite in the middle of their discography. And Camelot, one of those bands like I've heard so much about over the years. I don't think I've ever seen them live, but possibly they played Bloodstock one year. And they're a band where they're incredibly impressive, but in my like younger listening, I could never get the hang of them because they are so cheesy. Like, they're the kind of over the top beautiful vocal melodies are so like ever present in their stuff. The Black Halo is quite interesting. Like, I like the dynamic of having hundreds of guest vocals and guest choirs, like, you know, having Shagraf from Demi Borgir turn up as like doing his evil voice, and then Simone from Epica kind of comes in. Like, there's a lot of fun sort of variation in there, but it's another one that I got to the end of going like, that is immensely impressive. Like, vocally particularly, is incredibly technical. Like, all those people involved can really sing, but I'm not sure I like it yet. It's one, again, I need to give it more time and get in the right kind of headspace for it. It was just a bit too cheesy for me on first pass, but again, this is no judgment against these bands. I'm just saying I feel kind of unprepared to tackle something with that degree of legacy. So listen, Andrew Blair recommended Sonata Arctica, saying he felt any of the first four albums were a really good introduction. So I started the most recent of those, 2004's Reckoning Night, and I had a really good time with this one. This one, like, grabbed me straight away. It's, like, very fast, like, you know, everything really, like, plowing along, but then there's the super cheesy, like, orchestrated keyboards over the top of things and the very beautiful, clean vocals. Like, they seem to have quite a fun thing going on of, like, whenever there's no vocals, they're kind of... the keyboards come in quite elaborately and then they die down and let the vocals take the lead whenever like there's space for lyrics. And you know, there's some fun solos. Like, yeah, the songs were really catchy. I got on with this one quite well. I'd say first few tracks really had me, and then they lost me a bit with tracks like the really stupid The Boy Who Wanted to Be a Real Puppet. I was like, I didn't really get what they were going for there. And the chorus of Wildfire was a bit like, I didn't quite get what the vocalist was doing. But it comes back very strong at the end. White Pearl, Black Oceans is an amazingly epic track, and it all fits nicely with the theme of the cover as well, that the kind of the two wolves emerging out of the waves over the ship on like a stormscape. I think it's a cool looking thing. Fits very well. Yeah, this was a really charming one. I can see myself going back through their early albums, because I'd heard them before, but I think I'd got a really bad album. I think Stones Grow Her Name, the 2012 one. I heard them around that point and saw them live, and they just struck me as very, very poppy at that point in time, and this didn't have that energy. So I'm hoping as I go back through their earlier stuff, they're going to get a bit heavier with each album. Like, I'm hoping that's the way their music leans, but we'll see how it goes. But yeah, thanks for recommending it. That was a really good primer for this band. Ryan Smith also recommended Lost Horizon's debut album, Awakening the World. Now, Lost Horizon are one of those bands that have become a bit of a meme in recent years because they're very bad album covers, both both their two albums have really horrendous covers, and also just Daniel Heyman's vocals are so ridiculous. Like, people have regularly cut that moment out of Highlander, the closing track of the second album, where he just goes utterly ridiculous, like this warbling high voicing. But if you ignore all the kind of slightly sneery comments about them, they're actually really brilliant. So they're formed, I assume sort of formed out of the ashes of Luciferion, their fantastic early death metal project, which I really want to cover. Demonication, The Manifest, at some point, their debut album. Like, so like the guitarist and I think drummer are both from that band. Am I right in that? Is it guitarist and drummer, or is it some bass player? Let me check. It's guitarist and bass player. The incredible death metal musicians bringing their talent to this more kind of classic heavy metal, power metal style, and then teaming up with this utterly ludicrous vocalist. Like, the vocal ability in this is amazing. He has this tendency, Daniel Heyman, to just, like, he will start on what sounds like quite a high, like very like powerful sort of run of notes, and then just keep going, and at no point does he seem to draw a breath, and he keeps getting higher and higher and more over the top, and it's just like beyond reason that he can just keep going. He is one of the greats of the genre. Like, such a solid vocalist. Like, in, you know, he definitely steals the show somewhat from the other band members, but I think, you know, what makes Awakening the World really great is it's a really well written album. You get to tracks like Kingdom My Will, the 10-minute closer. Like, it's just a great progression and full of like cool guitar melodies and great riffing. Like, the album's really solid on that front. It takes a moment to adjust to, because this is like cheesy in the extreme, and as I say, you have to get past that. These are some of the silliest album covers you've ever seen, but if you're willing to kind of overlook some of that stuff, they are kind of brilliant. So I think what will make a nice follow-up to this one is the album Dreaming Awake by Harmony. So Zach from Are You Morbid podcast and Shuffle Repeat fame really knows his stuff on this genre, and gave me a whole list of albums. Unfortunately, there's about 10 there. I can't cover all of them, but they're ones I promise Zach I've made a note of all of them, and I will be listening to all of them in depth over the next few months. Like, I really enjoyed the first few I got into here. So yeah, this Harmony album, it's the debut album from Harmony, and it is one of those albums where it very much feels like a vehicle for the guitarist Marcus Sigfridsson. He is an absolute kind of like neoclassical shred god, and like the opening to this album is a 2-minute instrumental, which him and the keyboard player like throwing these amazing dueling solos. And you know, if you're not into that kind of thing, this won't be for you. But I think if you like a good bit of lead guitar, like, this album has some spectacular stuff. The solo in the middle of the title track, Dreaming Awake, utterly incredible. With this album, it's one where I feel like the real stars of the show are like the leads. Like, anything lead related, brilliant. Like, Henrik Bath, the vocalist, like, has some great hooks throughout it. Both the keyboard playing of Magnus Holmberg and Marcus Sigfridsson's lead guitar, absolutely amazing. The drums, bass, and rhythm guitar, for the most part in the album, feel really perfunctory. Like, this is not an album you're there for the riffs, you're there for the melodies, you're there for the shredding. But overall, really, really fun listen. And like, if you like that kind of stuff, like, I was really quite blown away by the guitar playing. And this is while researching an episode like this, where we've, you know, gone through about 10 ludicrous guitar soloists throughout this, and yeah, Harmony still really stood out. We'll be right back. Another album he recommended was At Vance, Dragon Chaser. This is their third album from 2001, so a fairly old one. And at the start of this album, first couple of tracks, I was like, we've done it, winner of the episode, this is fucking amazing. Just incredibly tasteful power metal with fantastic guitar solos, brilliant riffing. I love the vocal delivery. It's a bit more understated compared to some of these bands, and not so falsetto, but just amazingly catchy. Absolutely loving this album. And then it started doing really silly stuff that I just hated. There is a like metal cover of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, which just to my ears sounds really stupid. And then a cover of The Winner Takes It All by ABBA. And I don't know why this is such a common thing. You can't do a straight up power metal cover of ABBA because ABBA are just gonna sound better. Like, they're quite good at doing that. And yeah, like, when they're doing their own thing, they're amazing. It's just the covers in the middle of this album like really killed the pace for it. I know, though, listener Matthias, who sent a fantastic list in for this episode, is a big fan of this band. If you can find the Facebook post about this, he's done a best of playlist of At Vance in the comments, which I think would be the real way to get deep into this band. Matthias, I definitely need to bring back for his whole own episode on this because he knows this genre so well and will be able to bring some brilliant deep cuts to it. So, and the next follow-up to this episode would definitely be with him. So yeah, in general, really liked At Vance. Thanks a lot for recommending that, Zach and Matthias. Like, definitely a band I'll be digging into more. One Zach recommended that I was already quite familiar with was Darkness with Tales to Tell by Manticora. So Manticora, Denmark-based power metal band. They've been going quite a long time, back since like 97, and have a ton of albums now, always led by rhythm guitarist Christian Larsson and his brother Lars Larsson on vocals. And they have something, they've always appealed to me in this kind of genre because they've always had a kind of nastier edge to their sound. I got quite into their big double concept album, The Black Circus Part 1 and 2, which, yeah, had this kind of very dramatic feel to it. Their stuff has always got a bit more of a nasty edge to it. I think some of that's helped by Lars Larsson's vocals. His delivery is like very huge sounding, but it's very like heavy metal. It's not so much going for the higher falsetto. He's got a very high voice, but it's more just like very bombastic, very, very massive and intense sounding. And they do a lot of cool stuff as well with like harmony backing vocals and stuff. But keeping things a bit more evil, I think the sort of just like the scales as well they use their writing are very, very minor and very like kind of evil sounding. They're a band who've had a lot of lineup changes over the years, but all their lineups are like these incredibly technically gifted, like they always have great lead guitarists come in and drummers who can just like, you know, blast for ages. Like these albums where, yeah, they never slow down. They're always like incredibly fast paced, normally incredibly long as well, like often like well over the 60 minute mark. But you know, when they're on it, and Darkness with Tales to Tell is definitely one of their stronger albums, like I pretty much like this one the whole way through. Like they're some of their later stuff, the To Kill to Live to Kill or vice versa, those two albums later on, really enjoyable for a bit, but just like way too long. And especially like double arming them, whereas like this their second one, Darkness with Tales to Tell, I think is a really, really solid start point for the band. So if you want something that's a bit darker and more evil from the kind of power metal genre, they're a cool band. They have quite a unique sound as well. Like the way, I think particularly the way the vocals are delivered really, really makes them memorable. Another one on this list where they've just put out something new, they've got a 2024 album that I've not checked out, so that'll be something to follow up after the podcast. My friend Hal recommended me Dire and Grey's Gauze for this episode, their 1999 album. Hal has one of the broadest music tastes of anyone I've ever met, so I was fully prepared for a curveball here, and as he's introduced it, it came out in 99, there's some power metal in there, but it's a little amongst a fuck ton of other stuff, applying genres from Western metal to Visual K, don't know what that means. So it's always all over the place, this album. And yeah, I think... So Dying Great Band, I've never listened to because the haircuts were too cool. So I just missed out on them. They looked like cool guy music and obviously not my thing. But yeah, giving this a go, it is a very interesting album. It was so all over the place on like the two listens I gave it. I did not find something to latch onto. There's some moments early on that kind of felt like kind of thrashy, like there's even some like gang vocal stuff, which those I quite liked, but then whenever it took a turn to like, he gets these very poppy moments, like those bits I couldn't quite handle what the vocalist was doing, and I found those moments off-putting. So yeah, like a band I'd be tempted to revisit further because it certainly had a unique sound to it. Like I loved how the bass was mixed in the album as well. There was some really, really cool like stuff going on in the low end of it. But as a whole, yeah, I didn't love it on first listen. Sorry about that, Al. The last recommendation I'm going to get to today came from Mike Shields, and it brings things kind of nicely full circle. He recommended the debut Dragon Force album, Valley of the Damned, and I said in the Symphony X episode that was kind of the band that got me into power metal in my teens. Like, that was the one I first became obsessed with. That's a little bit of a lie, I think. I could be wrong about this, but I think the first band I actually got into in that way was Dragon Force when Inhuman Rampage came out. Possibly the timeline doesn't line up on this. My memory is it's a long time ago now. But I remember what like first seeing the video for Through the Fire and Flames on TV, and it blew my mind. Like that lead guitar playing of Herman Lee, I just thought was utterly incredible. So I immediately ran out and bought their first four albums, Inhuman Rampage, Sonic Firestorm, and Valley of the Damned. And then the issue I had with it is like, I love that first song, and Inhuman Rampage and Valley of the Damned, not Valley of the Damned, sorry, Sonic Firestorm had the problem of, it was just the same thing. Like, both albums are eight tracks where the first seven are that Through the Fire and Flames idea, which is cool, but is diminishing returns each kind of song you go through. And then the final track is an absolutely god-awful ballad that I can't stand on both of them. Whereas I think Valley of the Damned was the one that stuck with me a bit more for a few reasons. It seems like the one where they're being a bit more experimental, like they vary things up a bit more. There is moments that don't follow their usual kind of structure. And unlike with the next few albums, there is a really clear bass presence on the album. Like they're being like a different, like, that, you know, that being something that's interacting interestingly with the guitars is not something they kind of really did so much on the next two albums, at least from my memory of them. Like, I guess a lot of this pretty revolves around the fact I think the track Disciples of Babylon is absolutely fantastic. One where it's one of their catchier songs, and then rather than going straight into a massive shredding solo, they have this really cool kind of like bass and keyboard, like jazzy breakdown in the middle of the song. Really great stuff. It still has its moments I don't get. The track Starfire is absolutely horrible. I really, really didn't like that song. But overall, yeah, a really fun album from these guys, like doing kind of what they do best, where it's just lots of really fast, catchy songs, but with a little bit more variation that made it less tedious. And my God, is it a lot better than whatever the fuck they are doing now. I heard a couple of singles off Warp Speed Warriors. What is that? The Power of the Triforce and Doomsday Party. Some of the worst music I've heard in a long time. So yeah, so nice to remember that I kind of, you know, had some enjoyment for this band at one point in time. I think that's where I'll call this one for now. As I say, I'd like to do a couple of follow-ups because feels like a genre I've not delved into nearly enough, and I do have so much more time for it than I did when I sort of, I was in my like late teens, early 20s, where I was getting really into death metal and this stuff was all a bit too cheesy for me. There's still a bit of that there. I think listening to this a lot over the last couple of weeks to prepare, I might need a bit of a break from the style for a while. Like, I'm gonna go listen to some horrible dissonant noise for a few months to kind of cleanse myself. But no, I had a really good time with this, and as I say, there's all that stuff like Rhapsody and Sonata Artica and At Fans. So I'd like to dig more into, I'd like to try and get my head around just with these bands, these huge legacies, huge back catalogues. It does take its time. So as like, if you missed out on recommending music the first time around, please get in touch and tell me your favourite albums in the genre, particularly if they're, you know, slightly more underground ones I would have overlooked. As I say, I'll very likely do a follow-up episode, yeah, so please get in touch with those. You can get in touch Phil's Breakfast Metal on Facebook, at Breakfast Metal on Instagram, philsbreakfastmetal@gmail.com if you want to send like a longer message. So yeah, please do reach out if you've got suggestions on this theme. And don't worry, the next episode will not be prog power related. I'm gonna switch back to a different style. But yeah, thanks a lot for listening.